It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Wednesday was the deadline for Allegheny County employees to meet County Executive Rich Fitzgerald's mandate to be vaccinated against the coronavirus, get an approved exemption, or face possible termination. WESA reporter Kylie Kaczynski has been tracking the compliance with this requirement and joins us now. Kylie, welcome back to The Confluence.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Kylie, remind us, when did Fitzgerald issue the mandate?
So the mandate was first announced at the end of September, so employees have had roughly 2 months to schedule vaccinations and then submit their paperwork to the county.
How many workers are covered by this requirement?
So this particular requirement applies to anyone under the county executive's purview, which is roughly 5,000 workers. It does not include individually elected positions like a sheriff or someone, or those who work in the court systems, although I believe some of those departments have issued their own vaccine requirements.
Yes, and other elected positions like the treasurer or county controller. So the compliance numbers have been going up. That's what the administration has been reporting. As of Wednesday morning, what was that rate?
So as of Wednesday, Fitzgerald said about 90% of those under the mandate complied. So that's 90% of people submitted paperwork proving that they've been vaccinated.
The vast, vast majority, not just a simple majority, but well over 90% of the employees have already been vaccinated, not only protecting themselves and their families, but protecting their coworkers and protecting the people that we serve every day in this county.
Rich Fitzgerald talking with WESA reporter Kylie Kaczynski. Are there instances where employees are between shots as of Wednesday?
Yeah, Fitzgerald himself declined to provide specific examples like that, but I did talk with the sheriff's department, and they told me that in their smaller department, there's about 200 or so employees there. There are a few, maybe a dozen, who showed proof of their first shot. So at least that department is allowing for some good faith extensions. And then there were also fewer than 5 employees who were given an extension because they had COVID-19, and it's not recommended that they would get a vaccine for about 90 days from the time that they were treated.
Again, Fitzgerald did say when he made this announcement at the end of September that you could get an exemption. What have you learned about the number of employees who did seek exemptions?
Yeah, some people did qualify for either a medical or a religious exemption. The county executive said that that applies to about 1 or 2% of the workforce of, again, you know, roughly 5,000 people. So it's a very small number.
Mm-hmm. And the penalty for failure to comply?
Termination of your employment. You'd be fired.
I spoke with Rich Fitzgerald on The Confluence a couple of weeks ago, and he said people can make a choice, get vaccinated or find other employment. So it doesn't sound like that stance softened at all.
That's correct. I wouldn't say it softened at all. He told me Wednesday that human resources and legal departments at the county were actively investigating the employees who had failed to submit their proof of vaccination. And as we said, the mandate states that noncompliance results in termination.
And to clarify, this is either the 2 shots of Pfizer or Moderna or the 1 shot of Johnson & Johnson, not necessarily the booster. Is that correct?
That's correct.
2 unions fought this mandate. They represent county police officers and jail guards. They filed suit early on in federal court. What's the status of that suit?
Yeah, so that's the Allegheny County Police Association and the Allegheny County Prison Employees Independent Union. They filed a joint suit against the county, which basically argues that the choice to get vaccinated should be up to the individual and not the employer. Last week, a judge dismissed the union's attempt to block the mandate while these legal proceedings are going on. So my understanding is that these unions would now be fighting to reinstate an employee who may have been fired as a result of this. It's not clear how many people that would apply to between county police and county jail guards, but a union representative for the jail tells me that it would apply to about 20 corrections officers, which is a huge difference from last month when we learned that 211 jail staff, which would include corrections officers, healthcare workers, and others, hadn't been vaccinated yet. So it seems that there was this mad push to get vaccinated in the last month. The sheriff's office saw a similar increase. So I'm guessing that vaccine clinics have been pretty busy with county employees over the last month.
Did Fitzgerald talk to you about that and whether he thought maybe his threat of termination spurred some county workers who were hesitant to actually do indeed get the vaccination?
Yeah, he did sort of say that the enforcement angle of this was important. It may have inspired some people, but he was careful to point out that along the way, the simple majority of county employees have always been up to get vaccinated. So now we've just got the overwhelming majority of county employees at 90% who are vaccinated.
Kylie, you mentioned that U.S. District Judge Kathy Bassoon rejected the union's request to delay the December 1st deadline for the vaccine requirement. But this doesn't really end all of the legal proceedings, does it?
No, it doesn't. So the lawsuit is ongoing. And as I said, it appears to me that now these unions would be arguing that those who have been terminated as a result of not complying with a vaccine mandate, they would be fighting for them to get reinstated if they were to win the lawsuit. But as I said, that's an ongoing legal battle.
WESA reporter Kylie Kaczynski, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The annual healthcare affordability scorecard from the Healthcare Value Hub has ranked Pennsylvania 22nd out of 47 states and the District of Columbia. So what factors cause the Commonwealth to be in the middle of the pack when it comes to healthcare affordability? With us is Patrick Keenan, Policy Director at the Pennsylvania Health Access Network. Welcome to the Confluence.
Kevin, thanks for having us today.
Patrick, what exactly does the affordability scorecard measure?
So I like to think about this as this is report card time. I'm just about to go to parent-teacher conferences with my daughter who just entered kindergarten. And this is the exact same thing for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, except instead of looking at reading, writing, and mathematics, it starts to look at important things for consumers like curbing excess prices, reducing low-value care, extending coverage to ensure that everyone has the coverage they need, and ultimately making out-of-pocket costs, what you and I pay when we go to the doctor, more affordable for everyone.
How does this compare to past years for Pennsylvania? So the opportunity to improve, to raise that grade, but has the state taken advantage of that opportunity?
The top line message for everyday folks is one in two Pennsylvanians struggled to afford healthcare costs in the past year. That was true a couple of years ago, and it's still true today. And Pennsylvania stayed pretty much on par with its rankings. It was a couple of variations up or down, but really still kind of not really addressing, the needs of over half of Pennsylvanians.
How is it determined whether the state met benchmarks or not? Do you survey patients? Do you look at the policies that are on the books? What?
So it's a mixture of both. But for the scorecard itself, we really look at hard data. We look at, kind of outcomes as far as, were people able to afford the kinds of care that they needed? Did they have to put off getting care because they couldn't afford care? We look at things like the uninsured rate. We look at, how Pennsylvania performs to other states to kind of get a final number here.
Where is Pennsylvania doing well?
Pennsylvania is doing really well when it comes to making sure that Pennsylvanians have access to coverage. Our uninsured rate over the past couple of years has really kind of dipped to an all-time low, even though 5 to 6% of Pennsylvania residents still lack insurance. Part of that's because Pennsylvania expanded Medicaid and also created a state-based exchange to lower the costs. Unfortunately, where it lags is, either when it comes to affording care when they go to the doctor so they can have insurance, but they still can't afford the care that they need, or, prices in Pennsylvania keep going up and up and up.
I understand the state did well in what's called an affordability burden. What is that?
Half of Pennsylvanians in the past year had an affordability burden. That means that they struggled in some way, whether it's they got the care they need, but they ended up putting it on a credit card, or they put off getting care that their doctor ordered. They left a prescription behind at the pharmacy counter because they simply couldn't pay for it. So one in two Pennsylvanians had some kind of affordability burden in the past year, and 10% actually ended up, you know, not getting care at all because they couldn't afford the prices that were associated with it.
The scorecard mentions that Pennsylvania could do better at reducing low-value care, such as?
So some states have taken steps to really look at whether or not the care that was prescribed actually led to any kind of result. So, you know, that's really a step that Pennsylvania needs to take. It's taken some safety measures, but no one's really looking at, you know, did the test that was ordered or did the, you know, series of blood work, you know, that you got or the treatment that was prescribed, did that actually lead to results? And unfortunately for a lot of Pennsylvanians, it means that they're getting care that they don't actually need or it isn't actually addressing the problems that they have.
Patrick, give us an idea what other states are doing better to score higher in categories where Pennsylvania is not doing so well.
One of the things that we could do is actually implement what's called a healthcare benchmark, which is looking at the money that came in, the bills that we're paying out, and, you know, whether or not costs have been gone up and down. It's pretty common sense for everyday families, but unfortunately, there's no one looking at the healthcare system across the board in Pennsylvania. So states are creating entities that actually look at all the healthcare spending in their area and trying to set goals, almost kind of setting not a budget, but setting goals, you know, and targets that they want to be able to meet. When states do things like that, it actually lowers costs for folks because people are paying attention to, you know, to what's going on. Right now, there's kind of an effect with Pennsylvania prices being like a car that's just accelerating. No one's really pushing the brakes or even trying to understand why the car is accelerating. And obviously, that's a really dangerous thing. So we could create entities that would help us kind of figure out why the car is speeding up and help us pump the brakes more.
We just had Zachary Sherman, executive director of PENI, the state's insurance exchange, on to discuss enrollment for people without employer-based coverage. He said the cost for health insurance has been brought down this year thanks to the American Rescue Plan funds. Do you think federal support helps the state in its scorecard rankings next year or not because it's a temporary fix, a temporary help?
No, it absolutely does, and we're optimistic that Congress is going to extend the subsidies that were lowered insurance premiums in almost half for the majority of Pennsylvanians. It's really remarkable, and we think that Congress, under the Build Back Better plan, will in fact extend those subsidies. So I think that, you know, we'll have more than temporary relief. But Pennsylvania also created, you know, an innovative program in previous years with bipartisan support called reinsurance that was also targeted at lowering insurance costs. So it's both state level action and federal actions that's needed to address the needs of everyday Pennsylvanians. And we need to move in that same direction with the bipartisan support that created PENI as an entity that helps people now get, you know, their individual coverage. We need to kind of extend that bipartisan support into looking at other areas of our healthcare system.
Are there policies or proposals, legislation that you're keeping an eye on now that could significantly improve healthcare affordability in Pennsylvania?
Absolutely. One of the things that's been kind of top of mind for us, one in five Pennsylvanians can't afford their prescription drugs. And so there's been legislation introduced in both the House and Senate that would actually look at why Pennsylvanians are struggling with the cost of high prescription drug prices and look at explore state-based solutions that would lower those. So that's certainly something that I think would go a long way to making sure that Pennsylvanians have more money in their pocket.
Patrick Keenan is the Director of Consumer Protections and Policy at Pennsylvania Health Access Network. Patrick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh's East Liberty neighborhood has seen a lot of changes over the years with an influx of tech companies setting up shop in the area. Duolingo, a mobile language learning platform, started in 2011 and is headquartered in East Liberty. The company recently created the head of social impact, a position that looks at how Duolingo engages with the neighborhood and broader community. Kendra Ross, a Pittsburgh native, was chosen for the inaugural position. Kendra, welcome to the Confluence.
Hi, thank you.
What does social impact mean in this context specifically?
From the field that this role would normally be associated with, it looks a little bit like corporate social responsibility, but sort of takes it a step further and is really community engaged. It really looks at, where are we? Where are we conducting business? How can we be good neighbors? And how can we connect our prosperity and how well we're doing to the community that helped make us who we are today? I think that kind of local grounded community aspect is what makes it different from CSR.
What does being a good neighbor mean to the company?
Making sure that we share our prosperity and our good fortune of kind of growing as a company with the community that where we started, right? Where we do our work every day. But that means partnering with local organizations who are doing important work for the community, such as the Kelly Strayhorn Theater or Hello Neighbor or Catapult Greater Pittsburgh, all of these great organizations already doing important work in the community. We are supporting their work.
So the company talks about engaging with the community. You can talk about it from a neighbor standpoint. What is your role specifically as it relates to making sure that your product, Duolingo's product, has a responsible social impact?
Well, our product is already very mission-driven. I know a lot of companies say that, but our mission literally is to make quality education more accessible, universally accessible, and that's what we do. Our product is free. Our primary product, obviously, is a language application, but we also have a literacy app for young kids. We also have a language test that kind of removes some of the barriers that folks have that need to take an English test in order to get into a great university or to get a better job. And so we're already kind of doing that work. We're really just connecting the dots between our product and what we do every day and how we conduct business. And that looks like involving our employees through matching gift opportunities, where if they have a cause they really believe in and they want to donate to it, how we can match that gift, or creating volunteer opportunities for employees who are interested in maybe, the immigrant community or resettled refugees here in the United States and here in Pittsburgh specifically. Supporting that work, that's what that looks like for us.
I mentioned the businesses in the East Liberty area. So how do you balance that influx of new businesses, companies into a neighborhood, which might even make Duolingo a more attractive as an employer, while you're also advocating for the residents who make their home in East Liberty and other parts of Pittsburgh as well?
It's always a rough but delicate balance to do such a thing. It's a passion of mine. I did dissertation research on the impact of development on communities like the Hill District in Pittsburgh. So I think the main thing is to always remain engaged with the community, not only just kind of tell them what we're doing and share with them, but also receive from them, receive feedback, connect with them on a deeper level than just saying, hey, we're having an event, or hey, we're going to donate some money, but really engage with and have conversations with members of the community. I've been doing that just in the couple of months I've been here by meeting community members at, the local coffee shop, talking to them about, do you know what Duolingo is, what we do, how do we show up in the community to you? Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned, you're the first to hold this new position. Why now?
From what I've gathered from being at Duolingo for a couple of months is that a lot of this work has already been occurring, but there was no place for it. So it wasn't kind of operationalized, right? So one group would be doing one thing, one group would be sponsoring another thing, another team would be doing another thing. And I sort of had to be like an anthropologist since I've been here and kind of collect data on what have we been doing? So I think it's just, partially also we just went public this summer. And so we are, on a different level of spotlight, but also have access to greater resources.
We've been talking about your role as a neighbor and helping the neighborhood and having a positive social impact. How does Duolingo intend to make education more universally accessible? And how does your role play into that?
Well, first of all, by always, 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 always working on making our product better. Specifically, I'm talking right now about our language product, but also create more opportunities that will remove those barriers for people to be able to even get to the app, right? Do they have access to the right, sort of technology? So for instance, we even in the past had to donate laptops to young people in the community who didn't have access to the technology so they can take school online. So sometimes it's about getting people on the app, but sometimes we've got to get further down the behind in the pipeline and get people on devices, make sure they have Wi-Fi, right? Make sure they're in schools that have great, you know, computer science or STEM programs. And so those are some of the things that I'd like to focus on. How can we support, you know, educators, both in schools and out of school doing important work? How can we kind of remove barriers to entry into a solid education? Because for many of us, education is what got us to where we are today. So how can we remove those barriers and bring more people into the pipeline?
We talked about your vision for the job when you were considering it and then when you started and how they synced up. So what is the ideal outcome of the creation of this position? What's it going to be like? What do you hope it to be like 3-5 years down the line?
For me, my personal mission in this role is to help make Duolingo a neighbor and a brand that Pittsburghers, specifically local community members in East Liberty, are proud to call their neighbor. You know, I always bring up the analogy of, like, you know, Pittsburghers are serious about their brands, right? Like, when I'm in another city and people offer me ketchup and it's not Heinz, I have a problem, right? So I want people to have that same kind of feeling about Duolingo, that this is a homegrown business that is very connected to the community. I also want to expand that because we don't only operate in Pittsburgh. So eventually look at the other cities where we operate. Also, because we are a global brand, right? Build out a social impact strategy that our presence is felt in all those locations where we have learners. And we have people all over the world learning languages all day long. And I want, my goal, and I believe the company's goal, is to make people feel that Duolingo is in their corner and trying to kind of overcome those barriers and through education, help make a better life for all social classes and not just a small segment of the population.
Kendra Ross is the recently appointed head of social impact at Duolingo. Kendra, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Rebecca Reese, Laura Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.